Ken.
Hello.
I'm Lauren.
I am Ken.
And this is Paradise After Dark.
Dark.
Paradise After Dark is an independent podcast covering true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
missing people,
and every now and then an urban legend.
If you'd like to support our show and get a bunch of extra content, please subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/palmahawkmedia. That's PALMAHAWK Media.
And be sure to check out our cool little website at paradiseafterdark.com.
Yep. On the website, you'll find links to all of our episodes, even the archived episodes, our mailing list, our merch store, links to all of our social medias, and of course, our Patreon.
And on the website, you'll also find a small little tip jar there. So if you just want to throw us a bone here or there and help out the show, we'll give you a shout out.
Speaking of shout outs, on our CrimeCon recap episode a couple weeks ago, I mentioned that I made a after surgery wish list. I had surgery on my elbow a few weeks ago, and I just want to give a huge thank you to those who sent me some of the things from my wish list to make my life a little bit easier after the surgery. And that's Amy, Alex, Lynn, True Crime Nana, and Monica so far. If any more gifts come in, we'll give you a shout out on the next episode.
Yeah, they're great. Lauren's really been happy, especially the books. You got some great books.
I did. I got serial killer books. That was from our friend Lynn.
I snuck one of those and started reading it, by the way. I'll give it back, I promise.
Okay, so what we're doing this week is a little bit different. This is a rebroadcast of a two-part episode that we did in 2008. Side note, please excuse the not-so-great audio. Again, this was from 2018. So we're re-releasing these two episodes because A, this case is still unsolved, and B, there's some updates which we will be revealing at the end of part two. So let's just dive right into it.
Well, isn't there a release coming up soon?
Yep, I'm going to talk about that at the end of part two.
Okay, you can cut me out of there then. Okay.
Marcia Williams hasn't seen her son in more than 8 years.
You have any hope your son is still alive?
I don't believe that Terrence is alive. At this point, I have to find out what happened to him.
What happened to Terrence Williams is anybody's guess.
Felipe Santos and Terrence Williams both were reported missing nearly a decade ago. The only common thread is they were last seen by the same deputy shortly before they disappeared. And now some big names like Tyler Perry hope for some big leads in these unsolved cases.
According to reports from the Collier County Sheriff's Office, former Deputy Stephen Culkins told investigators he gave Williams a ride to a Circle K gas station. A few months earlier, 23-year-old Felipe Santos had vanished in a strangely similar circumstance. A sheriff's report says that Culkins told investigators he was going to arrest Santos for having an expired license, then changed his mind and let him out at a Circle K.
Filmmaker Tyler Perry says he will make an announcement today about 2 minutes. Who were last seen nearly 15 years ago after being picked up by a sheriff's deputy in Collier County. Perry offered a $100,000 reward for information about their disappearance. Felipe Santos was in a fender bender in 2003 and was arrested by Deputy Stephen Calkins for not having insurance or registration. Terrence Williams was last seen in 2004 after the same deputy stopped at his broken down car. Calkins told investigators he left both men at a convenience store.
Hello.
Welcome back to Paradise After Dark. I'm Lauren.
I'm Ken.
And tonight we will dive into a two-part episode about the missing men, Terrence Williams and Felipe Santos, out of Collier County, Florida. These are two separate cases, two missing men who vanished under strangely similar circumstances. Both of these cases are still active, and there's a lot of details and twists and turns, so try to pay attention and keep up.
We've done a ton of research and put together a timeline with as many details as possible, but it still can get a little confusing. Yeah, I'm even still confused, so bear with us.
Yeah, this case is in the news now, sort of bringing a lot to the forefront. But Lauren actually wanted to do one of this particular case a long, long time ago when we first started doing this.
Yes, it's always been on our list, but we bumped it up because of the recent developments, which we will get into probably not until part two. But it's heating up again. And there may even be a part three at some point.
Depends on how the time frame goes.
Depends on how things go.
Well, we've got a lot of discussion to do, a lot of facts to lay down, a lot of things to put out there, and then we'll go from there.
Right. So there's two missing men, Terrence Williams and Felipe Santos. I'm going to start out talking about Terrence Williams. So Terrence Williams was born on January 17, 1976. He was 27 years old at the time of his disappearance, but he did use the alias date of birth, April 1st, 1975. That's something to remember because that's going to come into play a little bit later. African-American male, sandy brown hair, brown eyes, and wore his hair in long dreadlocks at the time of his disappearance. Last seen wearing a short sleeve button down shirt, blue jeans, brown Timberland boots, diamond earrings, and a watch with white stones surrounding the face and a silver metal band. Williams had three tattoos, the initial T in italic above the left side of his chest, the initials ET in square block lettering on the outer right shoulder, and his name, Terrence, in red ink with blue highlights on his forearm. He grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and had recently moved to Naples, Florida to be near his mother, and he had four children.
The four children were still in Tennessee?
Three of his children were in Tennessee. One of his children, I believe a two-year-old, was living here in Florida with him and his mother.
Okay, that's my mistake then.
So let's skip forward to the disappearance. On the evening of Sunday, January 11th, 2004, Terrence Williams left his job at Pizza Hut and his mom drove him home. Once home, he asked his roommate to come to a party with him at a coworker's house in Bonita Springs, just a few miles north of Naples. His roommate, Jason Gonzalez, wasn't interested in going to the party, so Williams decided to drive himself, even though he had no license and his car was not registered. Now, he had lost his license in Tennessee due to a prior DUI conviction, but when he moved down here to Florida, he was working on getting his license back and doing everything he needed to do. I believe he was only maybe a month or so away from getting his license restored, and he bought himself a Cadillac, which was not registered and not legal to drive. But this particular night, he really wanted to go to this party, so he took the chance.
You know, how long had he worked there? Do we know?
He had only been working at the Pizza Hut for, I think, only a few weeks. He was working in construction during the day, and then he got a second job at Pizza Hut.
Yeah, his mom was driving, his roommate was sometimes driving to work, correct?
Right. He was depending on friends and family to drive him to and from work.
Yeah, and of course, when you're new at a job and somebody invites you to a party, of course you want to go.
Right.
You know, and if you don't have a ride, you're like, man, I really want to go to meet these new people. You know, who
trying
knows?
To fit in.
Exactly. You're trying to make new friends and be something, especially if you're coming from a whole different state.
So Terrence Williams' roommate said that he spoke to Terrence on the phone not long after Terrence left, heading to the party. Terrence was calling his roommate, Jason, from a payphone, saying he was scared to drive because there was a bunch of cops around. He just wanted to stop and talk on the phone and wait until the police cleared out of the area.
He goes, I'm just talking to you right now just so that I could see what's going on and, you know, maybe wait him out. After a few minutes, he says, okay, I'm gonna go. I said, all right, have a good night. And that was it.
So he was already really nervous.
Yes.
He was really nervous driving his Cadillac and not really...
Not having a license, not having it registered, the tag was expired.
Now, the Cadillac that he owned, he bought to fix up so that way he could drive it once he got his license back.
Yes.
So it's not a car that he was driving all the time. He very rarely drove it. He mostly just took care of it and was trying to fix it.
Right. And it was working. There was nothing mechanically wrong with it, which will come into play later. So anyway, he stops. He gets spooked. He stops, calls his roommate from a payphone. Mind you that this is 2004. Terrence did not have a cell phone. After a few minutes, he told his roommate the coast was clear, and he continued on to the party. Now, Terrence Williams did not make it home that night. The following morning, Gonzalez had some missed phone calls from a number he didn't recognize. He called the numbers back, and it was one of Terrence's co-workers. She stated that she was sure Terrence left the party between 5 and 6 a.m. Later, when interviewed for the Investigation Discovery show Disappeared, Jason Gonzalez expressed regret for not answering the phone that night. He thinks it may have been Terrence calling for a ride home.
I wish that I left my cell phone on my nightstand like I always did. That night, I just so happened to forget it on the entertainment center.
Gonzalez called local hospitals and jails looking for Terrence, and after 2 days, finally became concerned enough to reach out to Terrence Williams' mother, Marcia Williams, on January 13th about his concern.
Yeah, he did note that he kept his phone usually next to him in the bed, but that night, for whatever reason, he had answered it and spoke to Terrence when he had called.
And set it down on the TV stand.
Yeah.
And then went to bed and forgot it.
Forgot it, and it wasn't next to him in the bed because he had answered it previously when Terrence had called from the payphone.
Now, obviously concerned, Terrence's mother, Marcia Williams, drove to her son's workplace, the Pizza Hut, and found out that he had not shown up for work and even failed to pick up a paycheck. She then drove to the sheriff's office to try and file a missing persons report, because this was extremely out of character for him. Right now, we're talking 2 days since any of his friends or family had seen him, and apparently he spoke to his mother at least once a day, every single day.
Yeah.
So this is 2 days. So she's very concerned. She tries to file a missing persons report, but was told that Terrence was an adult and to come back if she hadn't heard from him in a month or so.
You know, so many times we see these cases or hear these of, they say the adults could just take off and, you know, disappear.
Yep.
And so far, I've yet to find one where someone just disappeared. I mean, I have, but to where someone just decides they're going to disappear. I've got a family. I've got a mother that I talk to. I have a job. I'm employed. But for some reason, I'm just going to go and disappear.
Now, he has a two-year-old son.
Yeah, I have no history of any mental illness or anything like that. But for some reason, I'm just going to disappear. How often do you hear of these disappearances where the people found out later on that, oh, well, he just took off and disappeared and came back 5 years later? It's pretty rare. So why do
police automatically always assume that?
Yeah, exactly, because there's so many people that go missing. Remember, when someone comes up missing, it's usually very time sensitive. What do they say when a child, you have exactly 5 hours to find from the time the child's missing until 5 hours later to find the child alive? So why is it when adults go missing, they say, oh, they may have just ran away? And I understand it's possible, but family would know best, you would think. I mean, how many of these people just come back? So anyway.
I don't know why they didn't take her seriously at that time, but that didn't stop Marcia Williams or her family from...
She may be one of the most persistent mothers that I've seen.
Yeah. So when the police pretty much told her to get lost, Marcia reached out to her family and friends for help. Her sister in Tennessee asked for all the phone numbers Marcia could think of, and she made calls from there. The family basically started blowing up the phones at the Collier County Sheriff's Office. And after so many phone calls from so many different people in his family stating that this isn't right, this is out of character, there's something wrong, the police finally began to take Terrence's disappearance seriously.
Yeah, you got to keep banging on the door before they finally open it.
Well, 4 days after his disappearance, Williams' aunt, from Tennessee was able to track down Williams' vehicle, finding out that it had been towed from Naples Memorial Cemetery. The tow record shows that a tow was requested because Williams' Cadillac was obstructing traffic. The tow report was signed by a sheriff's deputy named Stephen Calkins. The family contacted the police station and discovered that Calkins had filed neither an incident report nor an arrest regarding Terrence Williams. Marcia Williams contacted workers at the cemetery who told her that they witnessed Calkins pull Williams over and ask him for identification, which he did not have. Employees stated that Calkins patted Williams down and put him in the back of the patrol car. Before driving off with Williams in the back, Calkins asked the cemetery employees if he could leave the Cadillac in the lot.
So he went and addressed the actual employees.
Yes, he went in and asked the employees at the cemetery if he could leave the Cadillac there. Calkins was witnessed returning to the cemetery between 15 minutes to an hour later and moving the Cadillac from a parking spot to the side of the road.
That's a pretty big gap.
15 minutes to an hour, yeah. And that's a pretty consistent timeline that I have discovered in multiple police reports and news reports. We did actually get the police reports from Collier County Sheriff's Office for this one. So we've got all the information, all hundreds of pages of it. Bear with us, folks, like I said. So the car was reportedly half on and half off the road, obstructing traffic, and the keys were found on the ground beside the car. Marcia Williams was able to have the employees at the cemetery write affidavits of their statements and even have them notarized. She did that all on her own.
And the car was not, when he pulled him over, he actually pulled into the parking lot.
Yes.
And Calkins came and returned and moved the car to the shoulder?
Yes.
Okay, so, okay, I got it now. It doesn't make any sense because why would he move the car out into the road?
I don't know. We'll get to that. We'll figure that out. But yeah, the car was parked in the parking spot, in the parking lot at the cemetery. Calkins took Terrence away somewhere, came back between 15 minutes and an hour later, got in the Cadillac and moved it out of the parking lot, out to the street, half on, half off the street, and dropped the keys next to the car on the ground in the grass.
Okay.
And Marcia Williams, like I said, was able to go to the cemetery and have the employees write affidavits of their statements and have them notarized. Since no one at the Collier County Sheriff's Office could find any information on Terrence Williams and the family continued to call and ask questions, a supervisor reached out to Calkins directly to find out what was going on.
Cadillac, you remember it?
No.
You remember, she said it was near the cemetery.
Cemetery.
And if people at the cemetery are telling her you put somebody in the back of your vehicle and arrested them, and I don't show you arresting anybody.
I never
arrested nobody. So Calkins claims that he did not arrest anyone and didn't have a car towed on that day. He claimed to have no memory of his contact with Terrence Williams.
Isn't that something?
4 days later, no memory of this encounter.
We're talking about a deputy who was a
17-year veteran.
17-year veteran and had gotten to the rank of corporal, so he's put his time in. I mean, he's moved up the chain.
But how could you have no memory of an incident that happened 4 days ago?
Unless it's something you just wanted to try to forget.
So a few days later, Calkins' supervisor asked him to submit an incident report. All of a sudden, his memory comes back. Calkins' report states that he first came into contact with Williams at 12:15 p.m. after noticing that the car he was driving was, quote-unquote, in distress. The report stated that he came in contact with a young black man, but the encounter was so brief that he only knew his first name, Terrence. He claimed he followed Williams to the cemetery parking lot and that Williams asked him for a ride to the nearby Circle K because he was late for work.
Williams does not work at Circle K.
According to Calkins, after dropping him off at Circle K, Williams told him the paperwork for the car was in the vehicle glove compartment. Calkins claimed that he returned to the Cadillac and discovered that the proper registration was not in the car, and he felt deceived. So he called Circle K from his work-issued cell phone and asked to speak to Williams. The clerk allegedly told him over the phone that Williams did not work there. He then called in the license plate number and found that the plates were expired. However, further investigation revealed that phone and surveillance records did not back up Calkins' story.
Okay, I can't tell you how many times I've been pulled over and my tags were expired. I had no registration. I had no driver's license. I just gave the law or the police officer my first name. Told him I was late for work, and he gave me a ride to work and said he was just going to be really nice and go back and check my stuff later.
Oh, yeah, that's completely normal.
Is that normal? I mean, I can't tell you how many times this has happened to me. Not.
So
that's not something that would normally happen. You just can't picture. I mean, I can understand if he was legit, if everything he had was legit, good license, all that stuff. Hey, look, my car's broke down, blah, blah, blah. You know what? Jump in the car. I'll get you to work, but do me, you know, take care of this. But to...
No license, no registration, tags expired.
It's highly unlikely that you are going to get a ride to work.
And another...
You're going to get a ride to jail.
And another piece of that is in an interview, I can't remember where, but I saw an interview with Terrence's mother, Marcia Williams, and apparently Terrence was very untrusting of the police due to some issues he had living in Tennessee. And she says that he would never ask a police officer for a ride to work. That just would never happen.
Well, he was so scared of the police that he jumped out of his car and called his friend from a payphone previously.
Right. So this story is just not making much sense.
As we'll come to find out even more in detail.
Well, there was no sign of Williams or Calkins on surveillance footage from the Circle K, and the phone records for Calkins' work cell phone showed no call to the Circle K on that day. Circle K employees were interviewed, and no witnesses could be found to place Calkins or Williams there.
So no one has any recollection of...
Nobody saw a deputy come in and drop off a tall black man with dreadlocks at the Circle K.
And that would be something people would watch, because when police show up at a site somewhere or at the gas station the other day, I came home and told you the story, everyone's standing there watching. So anytime a policeman shows up and puts somebody in or out of their car, everybody's watching.
Yeah. So it was also discovered that Calkins requested a background check on Terrence Williams, giving an inaccurate date of birth, a specific date of birth that Williams had used before and given to police when he was arrested.
Yeah, ironically, which happens to be what we spoke about earlier.
The alias date of birth.
Yes.
So this completely contradicts Calkins' earlier statement that he never knew Williams' last name or any other personal details. Remember, he said that his contact with him was so brief that he only knew him as Terrence.
Yep.
But yet, somehow he's calling in, asking for a full background check, giving an alias date of birth that would only be known to Terrence, that he only could have gotten from Terrence. So at this point, Marcia Williams files a complaint against Deputy Steve Calkins with the Collier County Sheriff's Office. Now, at that time, the Collier County Sheriff's Office refused to identify the officer involved in the case of the complaint. The FDLE and FBI are asked to step in to investigate Steve Calkins due to a conflict of interest and to avoid any implications of a cover-up. Also, because this was not the first complaint filed against Calkins involving a missing person. We'll have more on that later. CCSO spokeswoman Tina Osceola said that state law only allows an agency to acknowledge that a complaint has been filed. They are prohibited from making further comment until the investigation into the complaint is closed. But that didn't stop Marcia Williams from advocating for her son. She took her story to the press, blasting the deputy's statements as inconsistent, and asked the public for help. 9 days after Terrence went missing, CCSO processed Calkins' car, looking for any evidence of any wrongdoing.
So they did. They're doing an investigation. So they're doing their due diligence. They've got in a whole different
now
department.
Now they are, yeah.
They've got a whole different department. So she's filed the complaint, and they're hearing her cry, so to speak.
And she's getting the press involved, which is getting the public involved. And let's just throw it out there that 2004 was an election year for Sheriff Don Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was stated by Detective Kevin O'Neill of the Collier County Sheriff's Office on the show Disappeared, on Investigation Discovery, that there was some trace evidence found, but it was crucial to the investigation to keep that information from the public. Now, Detective Kevin O'Neill was the lead investigator on this case. He's been interviewed several times with the news, with Investigation Discovery.
And his name is heavily on all the documents we got from the...
All the documents we got.
Yeah, it's all pretty much him.
Exactly. So the sheriff's office held a press conference along with Terrence's parents asking for tips. Hundreds of tips and supposed sightings were reported, but none of them panned out. At one point, a GPS was put onto Calkins' patrol car to follow his moves and see if he went into any secluded areas where he may have taken Terrence or dumped a body, I'm assuming. They identified 12 different areas where they felt searches were needed.
The areas to be searched would be behind St. John Newman's Church on 111th Avenue, an area with cut-down trees on the west side of Vanderbilt Drive, north of the marina, three wooded areas north of the marina on Vanderbilt Drive. The fourth area would be around the retention pond on the east side of Vanderbilt Drive, north of Wiggins Pass Road. Fifth place would be a wooded area north of retention pond. The sixth is a wooded area east of the retention pond. Seventh is a wooded area northeast of a retention pond, all in that same area around that marina. Eighth would be a wooded area east of a small lake on the north side of the Woods Edge Parkway. Ninth would be a wooded area on the east side of US 41, south of Woods Edge Parkway. The 10th would be an area south of area number 9 with a T of US 41, south of Woods Edge Parkway. The 11th would be a wooded area with the sand roads across Immokalee Road from the Strand. 12th would be a wooded area just west of area number 11. Now, in 2004, a lot of these areas were not developed yet. And the reason I wanted to read them all is because every area that I read would give ample amount of time, from 15 minutes to an hour. So you got to figure, if he left, remember the witnesses at the cemetery said that he was gone 15 minutes to an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So based on what I seen there and some of the calculations I did, he would have to leave, drive somewhere, and come back in that amount of time. So he's got basically a round trip time frame. So the areas here are immediate, Wiggins Pass Road, which would be immediate, so he could get back in 15 minutes.
It's all along the same
road. Yeah, but if you go all the way to the really heavily wooded area around the Strand, and he was able to get back, so when the question comes up, well, where could he have gone, these areas here are, so they definitely did their due diligence in figuring out time frames based on how far he could have gone and made it back within that 15 minutes and hour time frame.
Well, so, even if you gave him an hour, just hypothetically, he had an hour. The Strand is, I want to say, maybe 6 or 7 miles from the cemetery.
Keep in mind, we're talking about January. Traffic's a little thicker. It's a little heavier.
Right, but we're also talking about 2004, when Immokalee Road was not nearly as developed as it is right now.
Correct.
So
that's what I'm saying. A lot of these areas that we're discussing are the ones I went through. Those are real heavily wooded areas.
Some of them are still heavily wooded. Wiggins Pass is very heavily wooded.
It's getting there. Not really.
I think it was our April monthly roundup when they found that body on Wiggins, on under the bridge.
Yes.
On Wiggins Pass Road. I don't know if I mentioned it in the podcast, but that was one of my thoughts, that that could possibly be Terrence Williams, because that would have been less than a mile right around the corner from the cemetery.
Yeah, because the Circle K we're talking about that he claims he dropped him off at is at Wiggins Pass.
Is at Wiggins Pass, which is around the corner, the opposite direction of the bridge. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how to describe it to where our listeners would understand what we're talking about. Basically, we're talking about a mile block, square mile.
Yeah.
Block.
But what I'm saying is the areas I just wrote, like if you go to wooded area just west of area number 11, which is the wooded area with the sand roads across from Rockville Road from the Strand, that
was before Walmart.
Is currently a Walmart.
That used to be nothing. Now it's a Walmart.
It's Walmart. You drive past it. Now it's an apartment complex past Walmart. Mm-hmm. There's a new car wash there, a new bank, Chase Bank.
And they did find a body there in 2011. They found a body there that I believe is still unidentified.
Wouldn't that be something? But that's what I'm getting at. If that body was there the whole time, when they started developing that area, they would have found something. Maybe. A lot of it depends. You got a guy out there with a machine knocking down trees. You don't necessarily pay attention if there's some bones or something here or there. So when they say that they were building or doing some construction and found a body, that's somebody who just happened to see something that wasn't right. Because just picture you're out there, you got your earbuds in, and you're out there with a machine, you're knocking over trees and moving dirt because you got to clear this lot and that's your job. The odds of you actually seeing something like that, unless it's all intact in one piece and evident, pretty slim.
Well, at the time, after they identified these 12 areas, they searched for 2 days using aerial photography and cadaver dogs, but found no evidence. And Detective O'Neill commented on the dense wooded areas, mostly swamp areas, being very hard to search. Like we just said, at that point, that area was not developed. Dense woods, swamp.
And they brought in a Suncoast Search and Rescue.
With the cadaver dogs.
Yes, so this was a company.
That's
what they
specializes in finding.
Yeah, this is what they do.
Human remains. So Internal Affairs pulled records of all the calls that Calkins made into dispatch on that day that Terrence went missing, and uncovered a bombshell.
Now, a phone call from Calkins to his friend in dispatch, he stated that he had come upon an abandoned vehicle that needed to be towed. Both the men on the phone sort of had racial undertones, if you will.
They mimicked African-American slang.
Yeah.
Calling Terrence's car a homie Cadillac.
Yeah.
I got a homie Cadillac on the side of the road, yeah. Signal 11, signal 52, nobody around. Maybe he's out there in the cemetery. He's back in his car, I'll be gone. I got a homie Cadillac on the side of the road, yeah. Signal 11, signal 52, nobody around. Maybe he's out there in the cemetery. He's back in his car, I'll be gone.
So as you can hear, Calkins did not mention having any contact with the driver of the car, and gave no indication to the dispatcher that this was anything other than an abandoned vehicle he had come upon, even indicating that the driver was possibly in the cemetery and would come back to find his car gone.
Yeah, apparently that's funny.
Apparently so. Not really. So, when they discovered this phone call, this is when investigators realized that Stephen Calkins was lying. He was lying to dispatch about the reason for the car being towed and lying about having any contact with the driver. 20 minutes later, when he called dispatch again asking for a full background check on Terrence, but giving them the incorrect date of birth, that was also a big red flag that was poking holes in his story.
Abandoned Cadillac that needs towing within an hour of allegedly driving Terrence to the Circle K. And while the inappropriate language is in itself a policy violation, it's the content of the call that sets off alarms.
He lied. He said the car was abandoned.
He never mentioned to his friend this contact that he had with this individual. And to me, that was more important than anything in that phone call. It's just a big red flag.
Calkins later denies lying, saying that he was simply joking around with a coworker.
The more he was interviewed, the more inconsistent his story became. So let's just do a recap on all of Stephen Calkins' inconsistencies so far.
Okay.
So he told dispatch that he was investigating an abandoned car, even though his later statement indicated Williams was driving when he stopped him. Phone records show Calkins never used his cell phone to call Circle K, as he claimed. No one at Circle K remembers getting any call from Deputy Calkins on that day. Calkins later called another dispatcher, gave Williams' full name and date of birth, and asked for a background check. Calkins said he was alone, but investigators started to strongly doubt his story because he had had the date of birth from Terrence that was significant.
That was obviously the one that was the fake one.
The fake one. It wasn't his real date of birth, but it was a fake one that he had used in the past.
And that's not something that he could have just made up. He had actually used that a couple times in Tennessee, so the only people that maybe would have known that would have been family members, Terrence, and also arresting officers in Tennessee.
Right. So that's where we're at right now. A new lead in the case surfaced when a diplomat at the Mexican consulate in Miami called Marcia Williams to tell her about another man, a Mexican national named Felipe Santos, who had vanished 3 months prior to Terrence Williams in what appeared to be strangely similar circumstances. The diplomat tells Marcia that the last person seen with Felipe Santos was Deputy Stephen Calkins.
Surprise, surprise.
And that's where we're going to leave off for part one.
Okay, so we're going to get into the disappearance of Felipe Santos and then kind of give our own thoughts and some updates.
Next week. That next week will be part two. We've got a lot more information. It's actually still developing, so we might even have information next week that we don't even know yet.
Yeah, we've got other requests in for this particular podcast.
Right. So if you guys have any requests on podcasts you'd like us to cover, please reach out. ParadiseAfterDarkPodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Very accessible. Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes.
Please, please. We're not begging or anything. Please.
Please, please, please. Thanks for listening. Get with us next week. This is an interesting story. We're really, it's kind of tedious, but I'm enjoying this episode.
Well, there's been a lot of avenues of research that everyone has done because there's been different stories and some people have interjected some their own stuff, and some people lean one way or the other, and it's pretty interesting. So,
all right. So, thanks for listening. We will talk at you next week.
Thanks for visiting us here
at Paradise After Dark.
Good night.